But it was never enough that you be loved only as in a covenant between you and God. That was never the case. In fact, the whole call of the good news of the gospel is that God in his sovereignty has decided to see that you are loved by him, if indeed you will recognize reality and live with it. But he also wants to make sure that you're loved by one another and you exist as a body of believers who take good care of each other and forgive each other and laugh and cry together, who look after one another. People who advance the kingdom of God together. If there's any visual picture that the church ought to have, it's not certainly a rose and people looking at the back of heads. Truth is, it's locked arms. It's together. It's us. And if this is your church home, and ultimately the primary thing that you experience in your church home is that you are someone who worships with the larger assembly, you have missed most of what Christianity is. Certainly it has a worshiping together, but it has a living life together as we live out our worship. This morning I'm going to need some help as we do this, and I know that makes you nervous when I say that, but those of you who were raised in homes and your background was that I wasn't raised spiritual. In fact, my home was not a spiritual place. We really didn't think all that stuff was very significant. May I see your hands if you would say, yes, in the home that I came from, I wasn't raised very spiritual. Bob, you're sitting on the front row. Here you are. I can't hardly pass you by. Bob, would you take that chair right over there, if you wouldn't mind?
Take it where?
Yeah, take it there. Bob's a police officer. He's probably armed, so I'll be careful in how I say this. All right, second question, and you're probably figuring a pattern out here, so now's where I'm tempted to start seeing those wimpy arms. I'm sure of that. I'd like to know, and obviously I'm probably going to look for a guy here in a second, but if you're a guy and you were raised in a spiritual home, you were raised in a home where your family was pursuing godliness, and you were raised in a home where you cut your teeth on Scripture. Can I see your hands, if you wouldn't mind, on that? I'm going to choose Marcus because I see him there. Marcus, if you wouldn't mind coming up here. And so we have Bob and we have Marcus. Now, I'm going to just make a couple of assumptions here. In general, here's some things you probably know. If you were raised in a home that wasn't spiritual, one of the things the people in non-spiritual homes are taught is avoid guys like that. Because guys like that have a whole system of religion and worship and church, and they have hidden agendas, and you'll end up spending $19.95 on all kinds of things that you yourself will have to. God will bless you. It's a gimmick. It's a racket. There's preachers. It's nasty stuff. His family may not overtly have said that. I don't know whether they did or not, but non-spiritual people worry about guys like him. Now, on the other hand, I know Marcus and have known Marcus a long time. Nothing against Marcus's mother. She's a fine woman and she's here. I'm not going to explain so much about her. But Marcus's mom would say, basically, to some effect, Marcus, don't run around with guys like that, okay? You'll end up with tattoos that say mom across the arm. I mean, you'll end up with all kinds of words that we don't say in our house and we probably shouldn't say in our house. And don't run around with a guy like him. There is a little rain, in case you didn't notice, in that one spot. The issue at hand is, how in the world do you ever get those two somewhat together? Well, you say, we'll do it in the church. We'll do it around the gospel. The gospel will bring those two together, and that's true. The problem is, it's not automatic. The problem is, sometimes the gospel is lived out in situations where non-spiritual people like Bob wake up and finally buy into a little bit of the kinds of things that Marcus believes, and so Marcus kind of becomes the teacher of a non-spiritual guy like that, but there's a great big gulf in between them. We're in the book of Romans. And you need to know this visual picture. By the way, you guys don't have to stay there the entire sermon. The last 2 minutes of my sermon, which is, you'll be able to come down. I want you to stay there for a while, if you don't mind. Bob's excited. The book of Romans deals with a real set of people in a real place. And unless you understand it, it doesn't make sense. Not all the book of Romans. The church of Jesus Christ got established in Rome very quickly. The church is established there, but it gets a major upheaval in the year 49. Now, we don't know all the details about it, but we knew in the year 49 that the Emperor Claudius, he said, due to a disturbance among the Jews among themselves, there was a disturbance of some kind that he thought might wreck the political peace of the central capital of Rome. And so it happened before. It happened in the year 19. But it happens again in the year 49. Claudius says, you guys are disputing about a guy named Christus. What's that? The Roman spelling of Christ's name probably wasn't accurate, but something's occurring in the synagogues. What do they do with Christus? And the Jews were trying to figure out among themselves who they were and what they were. But Claudius expelled all of the Jews out of Rome. Well, the church is in Rome, and I can guess what it looked like. I'll bet the church in Rome was mainly led by Jewish leaders, with Gentiles who attended the church and were part of it. But I'm guessing that I knew who the Bible school teachers were. I'm guessing I know who did communion meditations. I'm guessing I even know who probably preached. People who could unroll the scrolls and teach the Old Testament, and people who knew of God's name. I'm going to guess it was a very strong Jewish-led congregation with some Gentiles involved. What happens in Rome in 49 to the church that a gospel that includes non-spiritual people like Gentiles and spiritual people like the Jews, what happens when the Jews are all sent out? The answer is it suddenly becomes a very different church. There's a title of a book by Gordon MacDonald entitled, Who Stole My Church? Well, that's what it would have felt like. Potluck dinners suddenly changed. Worship songs and tunes changed. How you led changed. Because it's Gentile led. And the spiritual ones aren't there. Claudius dies in 54. And when dies in 54, that is rescinded. And so the Jews come back. Now we have a problem. Because when he comes back, this guy is handling church so different than how he would handle it. In fact, it's that visual you see right there, you need to latch onto. And meanwhile, this guy over here is struggling because these guys come back and act like it's their church. And they don't like the way we're doing things. And there was great thunder in the church. So how do you handle that? What do you do? The answer is that the book of Romans was not primarily written to just be the basic theological doctrinal law book of Christianity. If you want the definitive doctrinal book of Christianity, read the book of Romans. I kind of thought that when I was growing up. Turns out, I didn't read the book of Romans very well. The book of Romans is one of the greatest pleas you will ever read for dear saint of God, those of you saved by the gospel, do you have any idea how valuable one another is to each other? And do you have any idea how the gospel is meant to pull you together? In fact, the object, and we will walk our way through Romans, and I know these guys will get a little tired of sitting up here. Danny, you can bring out the bench. The book of Romans is meant to take visually two guys, two groups that are way out there, If you guys want to get up and come together, and you're going to probably hang over a little bit there, but here's what the book of Romans is meant to do. And it's not just two guys who sit together. It's two guys who clasp hands. It is two guys in fact, I say only partly facetious. I really am not being joking when I say this. Romans 16:16 is the grand conclusion of the book. You'll love that verse. He finishes with, greet one another with a holy kiss. You can sit out. And that's the visual theme of the book, and you can't get away from that. You say, show me. Let's walk through. Because what we're going to study today needs a context. And let's go to the context. Romans chapter 1. I want you to notice verse 5, what starts in. Paul has introduced himself, and he's a proclaimer of the gospel of Jesus Christ. I want you to notice the end of verse 5. Why? To call people from all the nations, or all the Gentiles, to the obedience that comes from faith. Why would he say that? Because it's a divine purpose the Gentiles be in this church. Don't you dare, you Jews, ever think about excluding them. You come further down, verse 7, to all in Rome who are loved by God. The word all literally jumps off that verse. Why does he say that? Because stop being exclusionary in how you treat one another. By the way, don't you dare sit in these chairs and think in terms of first century Rome without you recognizing that the concept of the gospel has called you to be a lover of God's people with no walls of division and a caregiver of God's people where you are not exclusionary in how you live. And if you come and worship in an American church where you sit in rows behind someone and you say you're a part of a church because you come and worship in the Sunday morning assembly, may a pox be on you. Because the gospel call was never for us to come and to have some kind of connection that we meet in the same room and we call it belonging to the same church. This book is written about the intimacy and the unity and the sweetness and the affection and the care and the looking after and the holding hands, literally holding hands with people very much unlike me, but people just like me who needed the gospel as we advance the cause of Christ. It is a sense of belonging that is deep and rich. He will say all kinds of things. Go through the text. Verse 14 of chapter 1. I'm obligated both to Greeks and non-Greeks. We talked about that last week. The gospel is owed to them. We belong in this. Verse 16. I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it's the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. First for the Jew. Yes. Jesus was a Jew. Jesus began in Judea. Yes, the gospel was proclaimed in Jerusalem first, but it's for Jews and Gentiles. He's going to launch into a text in chapters 1 and 2 that his conclusion is this. His conclusion is chapter 3. Why does he say what he says in chapter 1? He says, you Gentiles have no place for pride. And he says in chapter 2, and you Jews have no place for pride. He would come to this congregation, he would say, those of you, Randy, who grew up in families where you had spiritual concept, and you had great advantages, and you've gone to Bible colleges, and you preach, and you know the word, don't you dare have 1 ounce of spiritual pride. You spiritual, by your background, you've confused something. Here's his conclusion, chapter 3. Verse 9, what shall we conclude then? Are we better? Not at all. We have already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under sin. As it is written, there's no one righteous, not even one. In chapters 4, 5, and 6, he will hit a similar kind of theme over and over again. Chapter 6, he will say, you realize, don't you, you're dead? That when you chose to follow Jesus Christ, you died to sin. You're dead. Dead people can't defend much. I've done a lot of funerals. I don't have any idea how many funerals I've done. Tons of them. And I'm going to tell you, I've misspoken I've said things that I probably shouldn't have said. I was a little sloppy in my language. I've been wrong on some of my facts, and I found out after I did the funeral the fact was a little wrong on some of it. I have never once had the corpse argue with me. Not once has the corpse argued. And he uses that basic analogy to even talk in these terms. Those of us who died to Christ, and we no longer live for ourselves, how dare you live with your divisions? How dare you live with the old sin? How dare you do those things? Don't you realize you're dead? If I go a little bit further on, chapter 9, chapter 10, and chapter 11 are the key parts of this book of Romans. In chapter 9, he turns to the Jews and says, God is sovereign, and God can choose to save Jews or Gentiles whether he wants to, whether you think he should or shouldn't. It's irrelevant. He can do it. He's the potter. Told him last hour, I preached a sermon several years ago out of Romans chapter 9. The entire sermon, I have no idea why, I talked about God being the potterer. And I put about three more errs, and I think I said the word potterer about 12 dozen times. But he is still the potterer. That's what he is. And he can do what he wants. In chapters 10 and 11, he says to the Gentiles, and don't you know that God still loves the Jews and he can save them? Don't you dare reject them. Chapter 12 starts in, you can't miss these things. Look at them. Chapter 12, he will say in verse 10, he starts this whole series of one another's. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Honor one another above yourselves. Verse 16, live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. In chapter 12, he will talk about we're members of one another. I'd always been wondering what it was going to sound like on a heavy rain in here. I think we're going to find out. You realize, don't you, that the implications of the gospel are so incredibly profound that if you're able to live without affection or tenderness toward other people, the gospel has been barren in your life. You realize, don't you, that if you're not able to lock arms, the picture of the church, Dale, come here a second. The picture of the church literally is locked arms. And be ye Jew, be ye Gentile, be ye spiritual background, I don't care what your background is, this is us, and this us will not be torn apart. That visual picture is so strong, you can sit down, or you can stay locked in arms. The idea of this text hits everything. We haven't even always done marriage counseling very well. Because in marriage counseling, we've talked as if marriages stood apart, as if they were a separate machine we to talk about, and we've done our marriage counseling, when in fact, biblically speaking, it comes back to you in your worship to Jesus Christ. You honor one another and serve one another and look after one another and you sacrifice for one another. Marriage counseling flows out of who I am in Christ. Chapter 13, he's going to say in verses 8 down through 10, the only debt I want you to have is the debt to love one another. You have that debt. Keep paying on that debt of loving one another. Chapter 14, verse 1, accept him whose faith is weak without passing judgment on disputable matters. One man's faith allows him to eat anything, but another man's faith is weak, eats only vegetables. That's in direct conversation to church meals and fellowship and having one another in their homes. Love one another. Chapter 15. In chapter 15, we have a verse that we put out here on the atrium west wall. That verse comes directly from here. May the God who gives endurance and encouragement give you a spirit of unity among yourselves as you follow Christ, so that with one heart and mouth you may glorify the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Accept one another then, just as Christ accepted you, in order to bring praise to God. Chapter 16. Chapter 16 in your Bible, most people tend to read chapter 16 the same way you read the credits at the end of a movie. It tells you everything's over, it's time to go ahead and leave, look over your shoulder and read a little bit if you want to. Paul didn't write Romans 16 that way at all. In fact, Romans 16 is the grand conclusion. I want you to notice what he says in chapter 16, verse 1. I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a servant of the church. I ask you to receive her in the Lord in a way worthy of the saints, to help her in any way. Do you recognize that name? How about by category? Gentile. Next verse. Greet Priscilla and Aquila. Who are they? Jews. He mentions 24 characters and he flips back and forth with some consistency. Jew, Gentile, Jew, Gentile, Jew, Gentile. Come all the way down to verse 14. You'll notice in the middle of verse 14, a Hermas and a Hermes. Those are good Jewish names. No Jewish parent would ever name their kids that. Gentile. And that's why you come down to verse 16. Greet one another with a holy kiss. College Heights has a future within the will of God. When we understand we are not just proclaimers of a gospel of reconciliation back to the Redeemer, but is a reconciliation that moves from whoever sits in that chair to the middle. And if you live such a segregated or hands-off life in the life of a Bob or anyone else, do you have any idea of the wickedness you perpetuate? Forgive, be gracious, serve alongside, and love. We are glad you're with us this morning. If you came into a worship service and later on you get in your boat and you leave. But the reality is you were invited to belong to one another, and any barrier that prevents that is sin. Now, that's the context. In about 10 minutes, what I want to go through is chapter 1 and chapter 2 in light of that context. Here's what he does. Turn to Romans chapter 1. In Romans, the first chapter, I want to read the first set of verses. Verse 18. He's going to speak to the individual. I don't think I got shot, did I? He's going to speak to the individual who is not spiritual, who sits in this chair. And here's what he's going to say to them. He will say, you have no right to pride. Yes, I know what you're like. I know your background. You have no right to pride whatsoever. Here they start in verse 18. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, his divine nature, they've been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they didn't glorify him as God or give thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. And although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal men and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. He just starts in and says, here's what you guys did. You non-spiritual individuals, your background, here's what you did. You walked by your knowledge of a creator. God has revealed himself. He has made his nature known in creation, and you walked by it. More than that, you suppressed it. And when you suppressed it and you didn't stop in the face of your creator, there is no depths to the level of degradation you've experienced. And the level of degradation has no bottom to it when you walk by Creator. In fact, he will say in this text, what you have done as a culture is not just deserving of God's judgment, but God has even actually turned you loose, and you're experiencing God's judgment in the very degradation. There's so many things we could say in this text. It's about homosexuality. Homosexuality is a perversion of life. No way around that. Political correctness is crazy. It's a perversion. But so too are the other 21 sins he mentions in this text. He just goes through a list of degradation. Just degradation. Why? Because you went by the knowledge of a creator. Creation. Psalm 19 makes this statement, even the Gentiles know. In Psalm 19, I don't know if you've still got the projector there, the heavens declare the glory of God and the skies proclaim the works of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. In the heavens, he has pitched a tent for the sun, and we could keep going. Creation. I asked him to put some slides up. Just slides, about 20 slides. They'll just kind of be running through a little bit as I'm talking here a little bit. Slides that just cause you to go, what in the world is this place if it's not a created place? I want to tell you, on a personal level, I'm like everybody here. There are days I wonder if I'm an idiot. I talk about Jesus all day long. I encourage people to follow Jesus. I teach what Jesus said. There's days I wonder, am I just following some clever myth? Am I just going through the motions on something that's just kind of a popular superstition that's accepted? I have my doubts too. And when I have those doubts, what do I do with them? Well, what I believe and the evidence for my faith has a number of building blocks, but I can tell you unmistakably what the first one is. The first building block that I have to come with every single time I come to is I can't understand life outside of a creator. I can't. And when I hit that fact of the creator, it begins to put everything else in the sequence. There are guys who will say there's no creator. You could look at all those pictures. Run back to that first one if you wouldn't mind. Just hold up on the screen one of those first ones. It's the baby's hand. When I read what others say, Richard Dawkins, many of you know Richard Dawkins, who he was in the movie Expelled. He was talked about a bunch. And I hope you went to that movie. If you didn't, you need to buy that movie when it comes out. The movie Expelled, Ben Stein's movie. Richard Dawkins has a quote from 1998 or 1999. The basic quote is this: you got to watch this universe. It's kind of tricky because it pretty much looks designed, but we know it's not. I mean, that's his quote. The universe is pretty tricky. You got to watch it because it looks designed, but we know it's not. A guy named Francis Crick, he was one of the guys that unraveled the mystery of DNA. He made this statement. He said, you have to keep in mind as a biologist, you have to constantly, here's his word, in fact, it's his exact language, constantly keep in mind as a biologist that this is random and didn't come by design. Well, we know they don't make such a thing as a simple cell. and you stand in the face of creation, and it doesn't tell you everything, but it tells you, I do not even have right to my own life. I have a creator. I live off rented air, and I walk on rented soil, and I live in a rented body, and I have a master, creation. I'll tell you right now, if you choose and want a life of degradation, you can make yourself go around that creator. But when you go around, there's no depth to the bottom of degradation that will come. This is not a pretty room. If we had people just stand up in this room, if we just had people stand up in this room, the depth of degradation would cause us to be so sick. We just finished a century, this last century that we just came out of. It was a century we had to number our wars, one and two and so forth. It was a century where we had all kinds of things. We had Stalin killing and starving people, not just by the millions, by the tens of millions. It was a century where we invented the way that you could get rid of bodies quicker by crematoriums. It was a century where we had 30 million abortions. It was a century where a Pol Pot could arise and kill 20%, just execute, straight execution, 20% of a nation of Cambodia. It was a century where in Rwanda, the Hutu and the Tutsi, and you could take machetes and kill 800,000 people. If you'll kill them, just cut them down with your machete or drive them into buildings and burn them down. You don't need anything else. We just came out of a century of pedophiles, a century of promiscuity, a century of homosexuality. And we're such spin doctors, we want to say to ourselves, well, I'm not so bad. Individually, the person who sits in that chair may not have chosen all of those things, but individually, is there any man who can sit in that chair and say, I don't need the gospel? And the answer to that is no. Don't you Gentiles have 1 ounce of pride? Not 1 ounce. I need the gospel. I need the gospel. Chapter 1 is that. In chapter 2, it will start off and speak to the spiritual chair. It would walk over here to Amarcus and would say to Amarcus, in fact, put up chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, if you don't mind. You, therefore, have no excuse either. By the way, that phrase, no excuse, is shown up in both chapters. You have no excuse, and you have no excuse. You who pass judgment on somebody else, for what point you judge the others, you're condemning yourself, because you who pass judgment do the same things. Now we know that God's judgment against those who do such things is based on truth. So when you, a mere man, pass judgment on them and yet do the same things, do you think you will escape God's judgment? It's a great chapter. We are incredible spin doctors. I used that phrase a second ago. When I talk about your sin, I can use hard words, harsh words. When I talk about my sin, I use softer words. He says in this chapter, you Jews who possess the law, possessing the law doesn't protect you. You didn't honor it. You have the marks of spirituality, like circumcision, but your marks, they do not protect you. You will be judged. He says one of the key verses in verses 10 and 11, Romans chapter 2, God has no favoritism. Thursday, Julie and I headed out and went to Branson. We got all the family together for our summer vacation, Dealey Wacker. We went down by the lake and stayed in the house. In fact, I came back this morning through a bit of rain as well. But going through Springfield, we stopped at Sam's. Julie was just going to run in and pick up one thing, and so I was just going to kind of circle the parking lot while she went in. I picked her up on Saturday. She did. She's running for one thing. The parking lot was crazy at Sam's in Springfield. It was, it was, it was, And so I would try to find parking spaces where I could see the exit when she would come out. But after about 30 minutes of that, I kept having to move because there would be some SUV the size of a bus that would park in the wrong spot and I couldn't see, so I'd move and I would circle around a little bit. And they had this sign. Now, I mean, one thing I try to be is law-abiding. And it ticked me off that nobody honored the sign. It says, no parking. The whole side wall along Sam's, no parking. Fire lane, no parking. And there were nuts. I mean, I wanted to. But they would come up and they would put their car in park, other men doing the same thing I was doing, and they would sit there and watch the front door. And they're in park. There's others who would put their car in park and get out and go inside Sam's. I mean, there's cars parked there. Ticked me off. Now, by then, I was there too, but I kept my car in drive. And technically, I'm in drive. I'm not in park. And I never stayed very long. I was on that wall, but I would always move every now and then. And that's driving, not parking. And I got tickled that the very thing that drove me crazy, I got amused. Because I found it to my advantage to break the law the whole time that I would say I espouse and teach it. The trouble with spiritual individuals is we're hypocrites. We always are. We teach better than we live. We proclaim better than we practice. We were sitting outside the train depot at Silver Dollar City yesterday. A sweet family came. Last hour, I kind of got the wrong pronouns as I described the story. I'll tell it a little better this time, but a sweet family came, about five in the family. There were a set of grandparents, but there were five or six in the family. I watched them come. I'm sitting there with a stroller and a baby on my lap, and I enjoyed watching the family. And they walk up there, and the train depot was pretty full of people waiting for the train. And the father says, I know a way to get in. And the wife says, it's right here. He said, no, come this way. He said, this way. And he starts to take her around the end of the building. And she says, what? He says, this is fine. This is fine. It doesn't hurt a thing. Come on, it's fine. And the grandfather said, should we be doing this? And he said, look, they expect you to. It's not a problem. And all five or six went to where the handicap exit is. And they bypassed everybody else in the train station and went through the handicap exit and got on the train. And I will lay you odds, they look as sweet and gentle as any family sitting in any row. They're teaching Bible school class and teaching Sunday morning worship service. Because we confuse spirituality with superficiality. Romans chapter 1, Bob, there's no place for pride. Romans chapter 2, Marcus, how dare you have pride? And every single one of us. In fact, as the praise team comes, there's one last visual I want you to see. Set of scales. Scales of justice. And here's what he does. I don't care whether you come from a spiritual background or unspiritual. That's where your life will always be. You need the gospel. Greg, you need the gospel. Scott, you need the gospel. And you go one by one by one. And it's in the context of how dare you not love one another. So I want to go back again, husbands and wives. How dare you fight? And how dare you fuss? When it was the gospel that should have stripped away every ounce of pride and made you to be his. The rest of the book will flesh more of this out. The invitation hymn is a pretty simple time. Do you understand your need for the gospel? Your need for one another. If you'd like to respond to either one of those, we'd like to talk to you as you stand and sing.